I want to welcome you to the U.S. Institute of Peace for this event, an important event. I don't know whether you recognize what a select group you are. We had to turn away many, many people who wanted to come far beyond the capacity of this room. Before I proceed, please turn off your cell phone so we won't have any unexpected or unwanted interruptions. My name is David Smock. Among other things, I direct the Religion and Peacemaking Program here at the Institute. And right from the early years of the Institute, we've had a commitment to exploring the relationship between religion and international affairs. And it's in that context that we're particularly honored to have former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright with us today to talk about her thoughts on religion and international affairs. She will do so in the form of a dialogue with Professor Susan Thistlethwaite, who is Professor of Theology and President of Chicago Theological Seminary. Susan is a very good friend of USIP. She's been involved in several of our activities. Currently, she's taking a lead in an interfaith project that we're working on alternatives to war. She has been, in addition to being president of CTS, she's been a professor of theology there for 20 years. She's the author and editor of 13 books, including several on the ethics of war and just peacemaking. Following the dialogue between Professor Thistlethwaite and Secretary Albright, you will have a chance to purchase Secretary Albright's book and have her sign it. I'll give instructions at the end about where that will take place. So you'll have a chance to have something to carry away from this important event today. My colleague, Ambassador Richard Solomon, President of the Institute and a strong supporter of the Institute's work on religion and peacemaking, will introduce the Secretary and make some other introductory remarks.
Let me join in this welcome, and this is probably the biggest draw event we've had in the last several years that I can remember. There are folks out in the lobby and the library, up on the third floor, quite apart from those who are going to be watching via webcast and other forms of outreach that our programming is increasingly attracting. Let me just begin a brief introduction by commenting that Ambassador and Professor Joe Korbel was really quite a guy. When I was beginning my academic career, I was invited to the University of Denver to give a talk. I think it was on China relations. And I didn't realize at the time that Professor Korbel was going to be the mentor of two secretaries of state. Of course, he didn't realize it himself at the time. But as I think many of you must know, Professor Korbel mentored Condi Rice, our current Secretary of State, and his daughter, Madeleine Korbel Albright. And as David said, we at the Institute are just very pleased to have Secretary Albright here, our 64th Secretary of State and our first female Secretary of State during the Clinton administration, of course. I think, again, I don't need to detail Secretary Albright's wide-ranging academic, political, and governmental career. She's been an advisor to a whole range of presidential and high policy position hopefuls, beginning, I guess, with Senator Muskie and on through Bill Clinton. She was on Zbigniew Brzezinski's National Security Council staff and brought her expertise on Russian-Soviet politics, East Bloc politics, to her efforts there. But over her career, of course, now with that added experience of Secretary of State, she's, of course, dealt with just about every part of the world. Back in 1999, during her tenure as Secretary of State, Secretary Albright came to the Institute and talked about the challenge of building peace in Kosovo, a region that had been torn apart by religious and ethnic hatreds. And it was the Balkans conflict that in many ways enabled the Institute, which, as David Smock has indicated, had a program in religion, ethics, and policy issues, to convert that largely analytical effort into something very practical and on the ground. This was the mid-90s, and we encouraged first David Little, the director of that initial effort, and then David Smock and others to get out of the region, into the region. And they did, I think, a very remarkable, innovative job building an interfaith council among the four religious groups in Bosnia and encouraging the communities that had been the driver behind much of the conflict, finding leaders in those communities who wanted to promote reconciliation. And this established some experience that we now continue to promote in a variety of regions of the world. Because since 9/11, and we'll hear about this, I know, in great detail in a moment, we've seen that religion has become an increasingly important factor in international affairs, unfortunately, as a driver of conflict, as one of the elements in that clash of civilizations that Sam Huntington from Harvard wrote about in the early 1990s. So we claim a certain credit for trying to work this issue in a very practical way. And again, we will hear in this dialogue some perspectives on it that I know will enrich our views of this great challenge, something that, of course, traditionally was not viewed as a relevant factor in international affairs. So, focused around Secretary Albright's new book, The Mighty and the Almighty, a great title, Reflections on America, God, and World Affairs, let me thank Madeleine Albright and Susan Thistlethwaite for being with us today. Again, thanks for coming. Excuse me for crossing your back.
Not at all. Not at all. Good afternoon. I wanted to start by saying that that I met Secretary Albright at the first Center for American Progress board meeting that I went to, and I saw that her name was on the list of trustees, but was somewhat intimidated by the fact that she would be a trustee along with me. And then she sat down next to me at a board meeting and said to me, "You're Susan Thistlethwaite, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, I'm Secretary Albright." I said, "Yes, I know." And she said, "I'm working on a book."
You said Madeleine.
You said Madeleine. You did. You actually did. You did say Madeleine. You did say Madeleine. And said, just as you did, "Working on a book called The Mighty and the Almighty." And I said, "Whoa, Madeleine, good title." And it is a good title, but it's a great concept, in my view. It's a good title. It's a great concept. And so I wanted to say, first of all, congratulations on writing a bestseller. And ask you if you would talk about, you have been talking with audiences of many kinds about this book, people in the public policy area, people in the foreign policy establishment, the general public. What kinds of responses are you getting to this book now?
Well, it's great to see you again on this, and I very much say that people have to remember I'm not a theologian, you are. And I haven't turned into a religious mystic. I am a problem solver. And as I've gone around with this book, I have found a very, very interesting reaction to it. I think a lot of people are surprised that I would have written a book like this. But also, I have found, whether it's in bookstores or universities or in kind of public forums, people are very eager to talk about the subject. In a way that I frankly had not expected, because there are so many questions generally about separation of church and state, or the extent to which there are discussions about real sense of certitude that our president has about religion, or what about in terms of what we don't know about Islam. And so there are whole hosts of questions, And I don't want to sound as if I have turned into a preacher or anything, but people seem very hungry for answers. Mm-hmm. And I had obviously enjoyed going around with my memoirs, and it was a very different kind of same audiences, but different kinds of questions, and a sense that people would like some kind of answers. So I have found it very gratifying, a little scary, frankly. Mm-hmm. because I don't have the answers. And but there is a hunger for some sense of understanding what role religion is playing, why we don't understand religion better, should we be afraid of religion? And so it's been a very, very interesting experience. I've enjoyed it very much.
If I could summarize the book as I understand it, one core argument is that religion and expertise in religion may be a missing dimension of statecraft, that you offer that as a hypothesis. And I couldn't help but think this summer, what might that perspective have brought both to the buildup of conflict between Israel and Hezbollah, and what might that perspective have brought to the diplomacy in a different way than as we saw the events transpire?
Dick Solomon said this, and I, you know, he has been a practitioner in foreign policy a long time, and one of the points, Dick, that I have made in this book is that people our age, my hair is actually the same color as yours, so I just kind of do something, we were brought up in kind of a tradition where you'd say, well, this is a complicated enough problem, let's not bring God and religion into it. It was kind of a sense that that was not part of the discussion. And what I have learned is that we have to understand that it is part of the discussion, very much so. And just to stay in the area of the Middle East, to talk about what happened for us at Camp David, because, and then I'll switch to the other part. There are a lot of people who think we went to Camp David because President Clinton wanted a legacy. That is not why we were there. We were there because Prime Minister Barack wanted to use the last months of the president's term in order to try to get a resolution on the Middle East. And what happened was that Prime Minister Barack was a very bold thinker, but not somebody that actually was very good at determining the politics of the situation, and he didn't tell us his bottom lines until we got there. And Camp David was very difficult, obviously, and I'm sure that many people in this audience, if I said, would you like to spend 2 weeks at Camp David, might say yes. Mm. I can tell you, after 2 weeks in the rain with the Israelis and Palestinians, I don't care if I ever go back. But what happened was that because we didn't know the boldness of Prime Minister Barack's proposals on Jerusalem, we had not been able to do what Dennis Ross's favorite word was, to condition Arafat and the Palestinians to what was going to happen. And I always maintained Arafat probably couldn't have made any decision under any circumstances, but he had every right to make decisions about the size of a Palestinian state. Mm-hmm. He was the leader of the Palestinians. But he did not actually have a right to make decisions about the disposition of the holy places, because he was not the sole keeper of the holy places. Mm. And so had we been able to get the moderate Arabs understanding better what was about to happen, they might have given him some kind of support. So when we started calling them in the middle of Camp David, they said, yeah, we don't know what you're talking about. So I think President Clinton certainly understood the role of religion in this whole process, but I'm not sure that we were able to prepare the ground enough for this. And it made me realize, you know, Jerusalem, if it was just a real estate issue, we would have resolved it a long time ago. Mm. But since all the parties believe that the land was given to them by God, there's another presence in the room, and we began to talk about issues such as divine sovereignty. And so it was one of the first times that I actually saw the practical effect of doing a better job in understanding religion, though the Balkans clearly, and I'm sure we'll get to that, also played a role in it. On the most recent issue, I think that part of what is happening here is that I have the sense that the Israelis, having a country founded on the basis of having a Jewish state, is increasingly feeling threatened by people of a different religion around them, who think that they have this land in many ways was given to them by God, and it adds a sense of argument to just a very hostile situation in the first place. Who does this land really belong to? Now, I'm not sure that Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, really thought in those terms, but I think that is part of what is giving them a certain amount of credibility. Mm-hmm. What, however, is giving them most credibility, and that is what's the most worrisome, is they actually are pretty good politicians, mm-hmm. and they know about constituent services. And Hezbollah gained a lot of support in Lebanon because it actually delivered services. And then the religious part, I think, comes on to it later. But the concept of a Jewish state mm-hmm. within an area that some can say, from their perspective, was given to them by God, adds a certain level of legitimacy to their argument. And, of course, the Israelis think the same thing. So that is always the underlying aspect of this.
Thank you. It has crossed my mind that Hezbollah has a lot in common with Tammany Hall.
Well, some,
yeah.
you know, but it's true of Hamas.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I am somebody who so believes in the promotion of democracy, not the imposition of democracy. And but democracy has to deliver. I mean, this may sound a little Marxist, but people prefer to eat than to vote. And so what has to happen is democracy has to deliver. And Hezbollah is able to deliver. Hamas is able to deliver. The Islamic Party in Turkey was able to deliver, and until some of the other rising parties figure out some of the better aspects of Tammany Hall, I think that that is part of the problem.
Yeah, well, the garbage got picked up,
yep.
you know, by Tammany Hall. Well, I want to go on with the point about democracy, because one of the things that any reader of this book, I think, will come away with is a sense of your profound love of this country and your profound love of democracy and your intimate knowledge of democracy. And we have discussed this before. And I continue to myself vacillate on the question of what, if there is anything to American exceptionalism, what is it? And how does American exceptionalism work in the best sense? And then, and you know that I am concerned about this, that how might the idea of America as exceptional also lead us into temptation, that we are less self-critical and self-aware of the temptations that come with great power than perhaps we should be? So I'm asking you in two parts, how you describe American exceptionalism in relationship to your love of democracy, and then how do we think about these pitfalls and allow for them?
Well, I perhaps have a skewed view of the United States, but for me, this truly is an exceptional country, and I spent a lot of time actually in my memoirs talking about this, and it's kind of the theme of my life. And that is, as somebody who was born in Czechoslovakia, for me, growing up, and my father inculcated this in me, is Munich was a decisive event. And the issue there was that the British, French, and Italians made a deal with the German, with Hitler, over the head of Czechoslovakia, and the United States was not present.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was a small child in England during the war, and when the Americans came into the war, there was great celebration, and everything was reversed, and we won, the West, or the good guys, won the war. Then, something, again, this is all very personal, is as a result of agreements made during World War II, the Red Army liberated, so to speak, Czechoslovakia, even though the Americans were like 45 miles outside of Prague. And as a result of that, Czechoslovakia actually was communist for 50 years. So I could go on with the theme, but basically when the U.S. was involved in a positive way, then good things happened, and when the U.S. was not involved, bad things happened. That is kind of the way I grew up. And then we came to the United States, and I came here as a political, I was 11, but my father was a political refugee. He defected. He asked for political asylum. And I got to grow up as a free American, and I really learned a lot about the exceptionalism of America. Now, granted, I learned my history in Colorado, which meant that we were on the side of the cowboys. I did not know that much about Native Americans. So for me, basically, the history has been, you know, manifest destiny made sense to me. And so I have been very proactive in terms of the goodness of American power. And felt what was so interesting about being ambassador and then secretary, and I don't want this to sound totally nuts, but it was incredible to be among the people that actually got to do something about expending or extending American power in a way that I thought was for good. Now, in many ways, I learned that if you're the U.S., you're damned if you do or damned if you don't. And, you know, we did things that I thought were absolutely right in terms of the Balkans and Kosovo. We didn't do things in Rwanda, which was a disaster. We didn't do enough in various places. But trying to figure out what the power of the U.S. was is something that is has been academically and then practically something that I've cared about. But when I worked for Jimmy Carter, for instance, I mean, all of a sudden, human rights was the center of American policy. And I worked for another immigrant, Zbigniew Brzezinski, and we used to talk about the exceptional aspect of America as a model, as a beacon. I then have been very involved with the National Democratic Institute. I'm now chairman of the board. And the purpose of that is for us to help, as I said, promote democracy, to provide the nuts and bolts of democracy to countries that want it. And so it's made me understand how important it is for the U.S. to act in that way, not alone, because we do that with NDI in partnership with other countries and don't think that we're the only model of democracy. So, I mean, I think I've explained that part, and it really is exceptional. But, and this is where I have real problems, and I do believe we're exceptional, but I don't think that exceptions should be made for us. I think that the United States is the country that should be setting an international norm in terms of looking at a variety of international values and legal systems and not deciding that we are so special that we don't have to, in fact, abide by any of the various rules, which is why I'm so terribly troubled by what is going on now, because we are using our exceptionalism in a way, I think, to undermine an international system rather than trying to figure out how to make it work. Now, I have to, it's obvious that I'm always introduced as the first woman Secretary of State. But, and I'm appalled that I actually did this, but about a month after I was named a secretary, I started saying, well, I'm not just the first woman Secretary of State, but I'm the last woman of the Secretary of State. I'm the last Secretary of State of the 20th century and the first of the 21st. Now, when I think that I said that a month after I was named, it's so presumptuous that the president would keep me 4 years. But he did, and so I am. And so I was thinking very much already about 21st century structures and what the role of the United States would be in terms of using that exceptional aspect in terms of projecting the goodness of American power, which wasn't just necessarily military, and then to try to work to develop institutional structures that would work in the 21st century. So, kind of a long answer, but I think.
Well, it segues directly into the question that I have about torture. And you say on page 193, the abuses at Abu Ghraib and other American detention facilities are inexcusable. Some will argue that they do not register heavily on the scale of human atrocities committed through the ages, nor compare to the many outrages committed by al-Qaeda and by Iraqi insurgents. There is, however, a reason why the Vatican's foreign minister called the prison scandal an offense to God and a more serious blow to the U.S. than 9/11. Is the new detainee bill also an offense to God?
Well, first of all, let me, this does go back to the previous question. While we are certainly not a perfect country, or had not been even previously, I did think that there was something very important about moral authority. And in this endless discussion that goes on between whether the United States should be a realistic power or a moral power. I've always thought idealistic. I always thought that was a false dichotomy, primarily because I never could fit myself into any category. You know, I have sometimes called myself an idealistic pragmatist or pragmatic idealist, but I for me, they're both. And so I have thought, however, that it's essential for the United States to have a moral foreign policy, meaning that we live up to our own values, human rights, freedom of speech, mm-hmm. rule of law, etc., which is different from a moralistic foreign policy, where we're kind of telling everybody else that they should live just the way we do. So when, in fact, something like Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo happens, we lose our moral authority. And one of the things that I did on a regular basis, and so did others, is we would submit cases where we thought human rights were being abused, let's say in China, or that torture was being used somewhere else, to the Human Rights Commission of the UN. And sometimes we succeeded in getting condemnation, sometimes not. Now we're laughed out of the room. So that moral authority that the United States had is gone, and I think that that is the greatest damage that has happened. I have said in this book, you know, when you write a book, you usually like your predictions to be true. In some way, I hope I'm wrong about mm-hmm. this. I have said that I'm afraid that Iraq is going to go down in history as the greatest disaster in American foreign policy. Not worse than Vietnam, not in the number of Americans that have died or Vietnamese in comparison to Iraqis who have died, but because of the unintended consequences, which we can talk about more, but mostly the loss of our moral authority. Mm. So that is a very serious issue. Now, the question is, what is happening internally about this? And I have always thought that our way of looking at the rule of law is central to the way that this country functions. The jury system, habeas corpus, and a variety of aspects. I'm not a lawyer, I'm just the mother of all lawyers, so four of them I have. But I do think that there are various aspects that it seems to me are not included in this detainee bill, and that there are real questions now as to how the system works. How long do you detain somebody? Do the military tribunals make sense? How does this relate in any way to our functioning system? But it also fits into the larger question, which is, what is happening to our civil rights? And what is happening to the civil liberties within this country, and of people being increasingly motivated by the fear factor? Very different from... And I do put myself into the kind of World War II, post-World War II generation, where President Roosevelt said the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Now we are afraid all the time. And so I am concerned about this bill. I'm not sure I fully understand it. I was very pleased when Senator McCain and others started having questions about it, but I think they made some agreement. So I'm not fully clear about various parts, but it doesn't feel good to me.
Mm-hmm. I would like to switch gears for a minute, because as we have had questions and when you've discussed the book at other times, I'd like to move beyond the book a little bit to, if what you were proposing were to work, what pragmatically might it look like? How might various conflicts involve religion in a positive way? What might that look like? What are the barriers to doing that? And what has to happen along a range of different education or other procedures that need to happen in order for what you are proposing to be stronger?
Okay. For those who have yet to read the book, but I don't have grandiose proposals, I have to say. But what I'm suggesting is that religion has to be considered as we look at various conflicts, which means that our diplomats have to understand the religious basis of these conflicts, which means that they, in fact, have to have training in religion. We have very good training for our diplomats in language and history and culture. I would add at the Foreign Service Institute a whole module on religions of the country where the diplomats are going. I also would make a point of the Secretary of State having more religious advisors. So what happened when I was in office, there was a piece of legislation passed which in many ways talked about the necessity, well, among other things, the necessity of the State Department reporting on the religious conditions within other countries, primarily the way Christians were treated. And also, I had a religious advisor, Bob Seipel, who came into the department, and I can't say he was immediately enveloped by the bureaucracy, because they couldn't figure out what he was doing. And, I mean, the department was not known for being a happy place for people that were integrated into it from other agencies. But he came, and he was incredibly helpful to me as we looked at various issues in the Balkans or looked at issues all over the world. So what I think is that the Secretary needs to have more religious advisors. For instance, when I went to negotiate the ABM treaty with the Russians, I knew a lot about arms control. I'd spent a lot of time in it. Did I know every detail about missile trajectories and targeting and various areas? No. So I took along a bunch of arms control experts. When we were dealing with some particular trade issues, I was not an expert on intellectual property or various things. We'd have advisors that went with us. So I would think that the Secretary should have religious advisors. I also do think that religious leaders should be used in conflict resolution ahead of time, which why, David, I think what you're doing is so important, is they need to be brought in at various other stages. For instance, the Vatican had something known as the St. Egidio process, which was very important in Mozambique in trying to bring the parties together. They also operated in Bosnia. And so I would have religious leaders participate in that. I would not have religious leaders at the negotiating table with the diplomats, because there does have to be some separation of church and state, but I would have them there as resource people. And then, perhaps most important, I would have them then be validators of the decisions. So they have to be a part of it. Now, the problem with my suggestion is the Pope. And now Bishop Artemier of Sarajevo. The assumption that I'm making about this is that the religious leaders are actually people who are able to bring people together, not drive them apart. And so I think that is an issue about how, in fact, you make sure that the religious leaders don't quote some 14th century text or don't figure out how to do something about it. Or I read this morning in total horror that Bishop Artemier of Sarajevo, somebody that I met and I went to his monastery, is now advocating kind of moving back in Kosovo, which is to make sure that Kosovo does not become any form of independence. And then, to add problems to it, Bishop Artemier now is developing a relationship with some of the Christian evangelicals in the United States on behalf of the same issue. So this is not what I would suggest, but I do think that it would be useful to get people much more of who understand religion and the religious basis of an argument into trying to help to deconflict.
Well, perhaps those of us who train religious leaders also need to look to our own house for training in conflict mediation. I want to ask one more question and then turn it over to the audience. This one is a more personal question. Your last chapter is called Summoning the Better Angels. And I wonder if both writing this book and the conversations that you've been having, in your view, are part of your journey of faith.
The short answer is yes, but it was a very, you know, when I wrote about myself, it wasn't particularly hard because I knew more about that than anybody else. But I had to learn a lot in the writing of this book. And, you know, some about American history from a different angle. As I said, you know, I had my view. And I also, I have to admit that part of what I was writing, I thought that President Bush was an anomaly in American history. But If you look at American history through a religious prism, mm-hmm. you can see he isn't. He is somewhat, but not totally. I mean, President McKinley thought it was our duty to Christianize the Philippines, even though they were Catholic, or maybe because they were Catholic. But I think that so I learned a lot in terms of looking at that. And then my religious story is a pretty complicated one, and it led me to one aspect that is in that last chapter, and that is that we all kind of get into group identity, that is, as the world gets more and more diffuse, that people begin to identify with their group. And I use my own life story as an example of this. I was raised a Catholic, married an Episcopalian, and found out I was Jewish. So the bottom gave me a reason to write the book, but also it shows that as a result of decisions made by my parents, I might have been going to a synagogue instead of to a church. As I explained, my father was a Czechoslovak diplomat. But for the fact that there was an outside force of a communist coup, I might have been teaching history at Charles University instead of being here with you. So, you know, that was another decision that I didn't have any control over. And so what it brought me to really think is the role of the individual as absolutely key. And so then as I did a lot of reading, it was very clear to me that every religion, as well as various philosophies, do agree at the centrality of the individual, and some version of the golden rule, and some sense that each individual has to count. So I have obviously learned a lot more about what I believe. I've done a lot of reading of the Quran and of the Old Testament and the New Testament anew. I have found blood-curdling parts in all of them. But I have also found very similar language on issues such as peace, justice, love, social conscience. That's all very similar. And so it has been a religious trip for me. But as I said, I haven't turned into I'm a problem solver. I understand more and more, and also from my travels around, the importance of faith to people, especially as the world gets scarier and scarier, is that there is this sense that there has to be a higher being. And then you and I this morning, we were in our Center for American Progress meeting, and we were talking about the role of science. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's obviously an issue as we tackle very complicated scientific issues, the extent to which God is a part of everything. So, yes, I have had a religious journey, and it's been very interesting. I've really enjoyed writing this book in that way. I don't think that I am good enough in order to lecture other people about how they should run their lives, but I would like to inject my ideas into the policymaking process.
Thank you very much.
I want to thank both of you for a very thoughtful and illuminating conversation. I think that this is the first time in the history of the Institute we've had a presentation in the form of a dialogue, and I think we weren't quite knowing what to expect, but I think you've demonstrated that this can be a very illuminating way to explore a complicated subject. We do have about 20 minutes for questions. And we have a microphone over here. If you do want to ask a question, if you would come and stand behind the microphone, I will call on you in turn. And as I said, after we have some questions and answers, there will be a chance for purchasing the book and for the secretary to sign the book. But anybody would like to ask a question, please stand behind the microphone. Identify yourself and then ask the question.
My name is Steve Sawmill. I'm associated with the Quakers on Florida Avenue. I'm not a Quaker, but I'm working with our interfaith group. Thank you so much. I'll talk to you with the book signing. I wanted to ask you a question about, you spoke to the Jewish Community Center not long ago, and you were quoted saying, somebody asked you, one member asked if Islam was overdue for a reformation. And the quote they gave was, You said people cannot live in the 13th century or the 6th century, you said. And then they gave some other interpretive thing about what you said, which I'd rather go with the quote. Let me just ask specifically. I think perhaps you wouldn't say Islam would need to be reformed. So I was sort of disappointed about the framing of the question. But how would you express it?
Well, first of all, I try, and I guess I didn't do it in that answer. I hope I did in others. Is I don't think we could just say Islam. There is not one such thing as Islam. What we're all learning, I think, is that, for starters, there are divisions between the Sunnis and the Shias, and then there are various subdivisions within those divisions, and that there are different interpretations of the Quran and what Muhammad said, Allah, in the course of that. And for the most part, what we are doing, for better or worse, is kind of typing a whole religion or a way of thinking by what we are seeing from extremists. And also, sad to say, every one of the Abrahamic religions has extremists in it of some kind. So I do think there is a problem for, frankly, any religion that I think wants to live in a different era. I find that very hard. I may be the only person, this is, you know, I am not somebody that thinks that people can live in the past. I think you have to operate within the world that exists. I do think that various aspects within various parts of the Muslim world need to think about some way of talking about their religion. I never know whether to say modernization or reform, but there is a whole way of thinking within Islam which allows and in fact wants to really support a reasoning process, an ability to talk about what is going on and evolve their religious thinking. And I think that needs to take place, but it doesn't need to take place by us, either Christians or Jews, telling them to do that. And so I think the worst thing that happens is if somebody who's not a Muslim all of a sudden says, you've got to reform. But I do think that many Muslims that I've talked to do in fact believe that their culture of a reasoning process needs to take hold more than it has in certain areas. So,
thank you.
Yeah. One of the publications on the table out there is called Ijtihad, which is our own contribution to enabling Muslims who want to look at some of these texts in a new light to do so. So you may want to pick it up
and
there.
And that's the term they use, the reasoning preacher. Yeah.
Yes.
Hi. I'm Yang Chen, leading a small think tank, mostly working for reconciliation and a strategy in this small country in Far East Northeast Asia, North Korea. And we know that you're the first secretary who visited North Korea. And the question I have is actually, I'd like to learn about some perhaps the practical implications or some recommendations that you may have the faith-based NGOs working in North Korea. I was involved in many different ways, working inside North Korea, making many visits, and some faith-based NGOs working very hard. But I think as we know, how this nuclear crisis is taking place around the North Korea, and I don't know whether there was any role that faith-based NGOs that could help that this kind of crisis could take a different path. And also I'd like to learn about your observation of how the religion could play a more positive role in a country like North Korea, and especially this faith-based NGOs working the outside, and they can make some positive influence to the change and then make more engagement with other countries.
Okay. I was also the last Secretary of State to go to North Korea. I think that the situation in North Korea is tragic. The place is run by a terrible dictator who is starving his people and not allowing them to have information. The reason that we dealt with North Korea was not because we thought that Kim Jong-il was great, but because it was dangerous and that it was very important, I think, to have had face-to-face negotiations with him. And I fully believe that you actually make peace with your enemies, not with your friends, and you can't do it if you're not having some kind of an exchange. So I would, at this stage, favor bilateral talks. That is on a larger basis because they are now, we are operating on increasingly dangerous ground with North Korea, Kim Jong-il saying that they want to explode a nuclear weapon. So things are getting worse, not better. I think that I can talk about my experiences in terms of communist systems. And there is no question in my mind that Pope John Paul played the crucial role in the end of communism in Central and Eastern Europe. We thought, actually, that he might help when he went to Cuba, but the Pope was Polish and not Cuban, and so the relationship of the church and communism was very different in Poland. But even in a country such as Czechoslovakia, actually, which was not a very religious country, the idea of religion played more and more of a role as they pushed back on communism. We know in China that there is an increasing activity for the church and faith-based organizations, although to some extent there is also a permitted church. I think there is a role, but it's very hard because one of the things that I think causes a problem in terms of our negotiations both with Iran and North Korea is that it's hard to talk to a country that you're trying to change the regime, where you basically, the idea is you want to overthrow them, so it's not a lot great idea to talk. So I know that there are a lot of activities based now on trying to get more human rights and faith-based issues into North Korea, and I think it's very much worth doing, but I think we have to be very clear it is very, very hard, and that the people that you all are dealing with are probably also exposed to a lot of danger in terms of dealing with you. On the other hand, my experiences in other communist countries, it is so important because the people have to have something to believe in as they are being starved or subjected to a variety of pressure. So I urge you to continue, but it's not an easy road, very hard. But I also think that the United States needs to talk to the North Koreans. Dick and I were in a meeting with the South Korean president last week. We were talking about the problems of what happens if they explode a nuclear weapon.
We'll move to the next question.
Thank you for being here. My name is David Buckley, and I work with Faith and Public Life, which actually shares a building with American Progress. So, I lived in Belfast last year and worked over there. And with the history of the Troubles and coming up to the present progress that's been made, faith communities were involved with communities, particularly on the Loyalist and Republican side, that diplomats couldn't penetrate. They could engage publicly and privately with groups that mainstream diplomats had trouble reaching at the early stages and then continue to engage after the peace treaty was signed. And I was wondering if either with your experience in the Balkans or in the Middle East, you saw other examples where religious actors were particularly able to reach hardline fringes of communities that diplomats had trouble engaging because of political necessity.
Well, Ireland is the best. I mean, Northern Ireland is definitely the best example of it. And for me, I have to say, originally when I came up on the issue, I thought, can you believe we're having a religious war in the 20th century? So it was one of the first things that really kind of brought this home as being a practical political issue. To some extent, there is some work that has been done in some of the African countries where there I think most people don't realize that many African countries have huge Muslim populations and that their work with the Christians in various places in Sudan and the North-South issue, some in Mozambique, but not a lot. And what worries me now, there was an effort to some extent in the Balkans, and not just the St. Egidio process, but In contrast to Bishop Bartemier, there was this Father Sava, I think, that you worked with, who was somebody that had a different view of what could be done. The role that I find interesting, and I don't know to what extent one can capitalize on this, I think the emigre communities can in many ways play a positive role. To the most part, they play a negative role. But I think that their religious communities, I think, could help also then influence in the other countries. I was so distressed on my recent trip to Kosovo because when I went there, when we were in office, you saw the mosques all destroyed and behind barbed wire. When I was there last summer, it's now the Orthodox cathedrals, et cetera, that are all destroyed and behind barbed wire. So more has to be done. And one always talks about the Irish example as something that can help somewhere else. What I think would also be interesting is if some of the people that were not Americans, but the Irish that were involved in that, if they then could go and help in the Balkans rather than the Americans doing it.
Thank you. I appreciate the work you've done in your book. I've already given three copies to people. My name is Elias Mallon, and my field is Islam, and I'm at Franciscans International, an NGO at the United Nations. I'm a Roman Catholic. One of the things in dealing with religion is it is somewhat of a mixed bag. The assumption many times is that the best in religion are those things that look for dialogue and cooperation. I also see shadow sides, and the specific shadow side that I see is apocalypticism. You know, as soon as the outbreak of hostilities in Lebanon, a whole bunch of Americans, some powerful Americans, start to speak about Armageddon. 2 weeks ago, 40 of us met with the president of Iran. And while most people were upset by his stock line about Israel and the Holocaust, a few of us picked up him speaking about Mahdism, that the Mahdi was back. Once you get apocalyptic people, whether there's less among Jews, but still some there too, apocalyptic people, whether they be Christians, Muslims, or Jews, want to provoke crisis, not overcome it, because the crisis is a desirable thing that that brings in the end time in which they're going to be the leaders. And so in in dealing with religion, which I agree is extremely important, it's also, I think, important to understand the shadow side of all of our faith traditions and how they may actually theologically impact for a very, very negative way.
I totally agree with you, and in the book I actually talk about some of the problems of the Rapture series and people feeling that they would like the end of the world to come. When I am having a policy discussion on American policy, and you know, I mentioned originally that one of the reasons I wrote the book as a hypothesis that I sort of didn't prove or proved halfway is that Bush was an anomaly. The certitude that President Bush has about his relationship with God, and I have a quote in the book that says, "God wants me to be president," has an effect on policy when there is such certitude and plan A doesn't work, you don't have a plan B. And I now, in some of my talks, say Armageddon is not a policy. That could be a bumper sticker. Because you can't operate on the basis that the end of the world is coming and we might as well be the ones that go to heaven. The most recent example of at the Clinton Global Initiative, Archbishop Tutu was there, who is, to me, the personification of somebody who has understood the value of religion. And he made a point, which I will now steal everywhere, which he said, religion is like a knife. You can either use it to cut bread or stick into somebody's back. And so in many ways, it is a tool, and the real problem is how you avoid the apocalyptic types or those that want to use it for their own purposes. But that is the hardest part, and it is the summoning the better angels. But it's scary. I think there's no way. And so that's why I say they're extremists in all the religions. And that's why I'm, for instance, worried in what I read in the papers today about Artemye and some kind of very... my hardest time, frankly, Susan, I've talked to you about this, is even finding the right nouns and adjectives, because mm-hmm. fundamentalism isn't bad, it's extremism mm-hmm. that is bad. So if the extremists in Christianity then link up with the extremists in, or they're all Christians, but the American Christian groups with the Orthodox, you run into a problem. But it is the danger. It is the, so one of the answers, which is a political answer, is... we don't know what is really creating all the extremists. You know, what makes somebody a terrorist? And some of it has to do with the fact that their lives on Earth are awful, that there's poverty and lack of dignity and lack of a sense of one's worth. Now, that is a very long-term project. You know, I think most people, I can't speak for most people, I would prefer to live, but I think that there is something about the sense that life is so awful that you would prefer to have it end and go on to something else. But I was raised a Catholic. I know this is all just supposed to be a veil of tears on the, you know, I happen to have had a pretty good time. So, but I do think it is a problem. It is a, you touched on a very serious problem, and it's how to use the religious tool, which is what I'm looking at, in a positive and not a negative way.
Thank you.
Let me also say that I mean, I agree with Madeline that fundamentalism is not eo ipso bad, but that there is something of a clash of fundamentalisms or a clash of absolute certainties that I think describes and there are hallmarks of when religion becomes violent. I mean, people have studied when and a end justifies any means, absolute certainty. And the disrespect for human rights, there are characteristics of when religion is willing to be a partner with the destruction of human life. And there is a theology of destroying the world to save it that I think characterizes this clash that is extremely dangerous.
But, you know, the hardest part, as I said, I really learned a lot and did reading, the kind that I haven't done since college, mm-hmm. frankly. But I would be, if you read about absolutism versus relativism, I would sit there and I'd read and I'd say, yeah, I really believe that. And then I'd read the relativist part and I'd say, no, I'm much more of a relativist. and I think that it's a very hard thing of trying to balance having some doubt about what you believe in and having some sense that not everything is up for discussion.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I think we all go back and forth on this. But, you know, I happen to think that anybody who thinks they're absolutely right, it gets you into trouble. But if you say nothing matters. So it's one of the tougher discussions.
The only one who's absolutely right is God.
Right.
And the rest of us are finite.
And anyone who's the only one who's absolutely good is God, because even yeah. Jesus Christ said, "Who am I?"
There's none good but God. Exactly. Yeah.
Yes.
Hi, yes. Thank you, Secretary, for your comments. My name is Catherine Cardwin. I was actually a religion major in college, and now I'm at the Iraqi Women's Democracy Initiative at the Department of State. And I'd be so interested to hear your perspective on how religion can best be utilized now to mitigate tensions and prevent the escalation of communal conflict in Iraq.
Well, let me just say, to go back on something, I said I was chairman of the board of the National Democratic Institute. We are in Iraq working on democracy projects, and not just as Americans, but primarily it's a multinational team with a lot of Canadians. And so I do think that there is a lot going on under the surface of all the violence. I also do think that in smaller groups, there needs to be some of the again, I have such a terrible time with the terms, more moderate of the religious leaders from the various groupings need to work in small groups with then ever-expanding groups of people to say that they don't necessarily have to kill each other. But there also is a very interesting and strong sense from Ayatollah Sistani, for instance, who is somebody that has been the person that, to many ways, wanted the elections, has been concerned with some aspects of getting people more involved in what they're doing. So I do think there's a role for religious leaders. The question is how to provide enough security in Iraq so that people can actually meet think about religion and think about the political system. And so that's where the American presence is both the solution and the problem, because security is needed, and yet to some extent we are a magnet for a lot of the violence. So, but I do think the only ultimate resolution here will be is for there to be some religious understanding and not to get ourselves into a Shia-Sunni conflict or a Persian-Arab war.
Thank you.
I actually have a question relative to that. It is my impression, but your field. But my impression is that in places like Iraq, but certainly around the world, that in the absence of the existence of democratic structures, that people actually use religious affiliation as a substitute for political parties because such structures have not evolved. And there's no one can be in this country a Christian, a Jew, a Muslim, a Buddhist, and be a Democrat or a Republican. But in the absence of interfaith, separation of church and state, political affiliation, religion is functioning as a substitute for political parties.
Some, is but that, there is no there? Division. One of the things that is really hard for us to grasp is there is no separation of church and state in Muslim under Islam. That they are together, and that is why that is so hard, and the concept of modernization. But I do think that religion in many places provides a structure. It does here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people that are lost go to these huge evangelical in Texas and various mm-hmm. places. It provides a communal structure, and mm-hmm. I think it definitely does there. And one of the things, someday I'm going to teach a course on the unintended consequences of foreign policy decisions. And one of the big ones was when, during the Carter administration, when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, and we wanted to push them back, but mostly we wanted to punish them, and all of a sudden the Mujahideen are there. My boss, Zbigniew Brzezinski, goes to the Khyber Pass and looks at these people and says, God is on your side. And so from there on, it moves to the fact that this is something where a religious concept of fighting back against totalitarianism becomes, I mean, he didn't invent it, but mm-hmm. it certainly is something that then became a structure.
I'm Joe Annunziata. I'm with Pax Christi International, a Catholic group, and I'm their NGO representative at the United Nations. I wanted to ask you a question about current attitude, at least, of the U.S. trying to solve all of these international problems by itself versus calling more upon other international multilateral organizations or even groups like Sant'Egidio, people who have been involved for many, many years in some of these local and regional problems, and the need for us sometimes to sit back and relinquish this desire or this impulse to try to go in there and do it ourselves. We were so prominent in establishing the United Nations after World War II, and more recently it seems as though we have felt that, well, we don't need the United Nations and they do a lousy job, they're incompetent. We have contributed, I think, in large part to the world image of an incompetent and impossible United Nations. I wonder, with your experience there, you can give us some ideas.
I mean, I think this is where what comes in, what I said earlier, if the United States, you're damned if you do or damned if you don't. I mean, if we are not fully involved in helping to resolve an issue, then people say that we don't care about it. But I personally have believed that we are the indispensable nation. We have to be involved. And whether you read the New Testament or Spider-Man, to whom much is given, much is expected. And so I do think that the United States has a very important role to play. But in my saying that we're indispensable, I never said alone, that it was very important to operate in partnership with other countries through and with international organizations when you can. We used to say, you know, multilaterally if you can, unilaterally if you must. But we wanted to operate through the UN. I have been a great advocate of the UN and found it very interesting when I was there that we more and more, obviously the Vatican has observer status at the United Nations. And what began to happen while we were there was with the growth of non-governmental organizations, more and more of them became observers to the UN or would go to various conferences and in some way play a part, so that there was more and more of a recognition that there was a role for something beyond just government-to-government action. And I think that I see it now that I'm not in the government, I really see more and more value for non-governmental organizations of various levels to operate on something. The UN does need reforming. There's no question about it. And, you know, the U.S., when we were in office, we owed a tremendous amount of money, which made it very difficult for us to have influence in reform, leading the British, our best friends, to deliver a line they'd waited more than 200 years to say, which was representation without taxation. So it made it hard to have that kind of leverage. I think that people forget that the UN is just the sum of its parts, the nation states. It isn't as if there was some disembodied UN that kind of operates on the side. And the thing that I've said that troubles me the most at the moment is that there are people in the U.S., some of them in the government, who are afraid of the United Nations. They actually think it swoops down and has black helicopters and swoops down in the middle of the night, steal your lawn furniture. And then there are people who don't like the UN because it's full of foreigners, which frankly can't be helped. So, I am a great believer in the UN, and I hope very much that it will be restructured in a way that the U.S. finds that, I do teach a course on the National Security Toolbox. Multilateral diplomacy is a very important tool for the United States. And in order to have it work, you have to have the UN and other organizations functional. So,
thank you.
Yeah.
We have time for just two more brief questions.
And brief answers.
And brief answers.
Laura Konda, Albanian Service of Voice of America. In your book, you mention the fact that the seeds of the conflict in Kosovo was also religious. You also mentioned today Bishop Artemia and some extremist groups in Serbia, but also in the U.S. Now they are talking about the risk of creating another independent Muslim state in the middle of Europe. What would be your comment on that?
Well, the talks are going on, and one of the things is I felt obviously very strongly about Kosovo. I think people often ask me what I'm proudest of as Secretary of State. It definitely was intervention in Kosovo. So, but I think that there are any number of reasons. I'm sorry that there isn't a President Gore. But one of the things was that I think that the Balkans were kind of abandoned because the United States at the moment doesn't have so much of a unilateral foreign policy as it has a unidimensional foreign policy. It's all military aimed at the Middle East. And the Balkans was forgotten. And Kosovo, frankly, I think had the international community was supposed to be in charge of helping the Kosovars to systematically assume certain duties within the government, and that wasn't really done. So there has been a level of frustration built up among Kosovars that is very hard to deal with now. I think it's inappropriate for me to say what the solution is, but I do think that I am very interested in what Matti Ahtisaari is going to suggest through this process, and I think that it will be some, I don't know, but I would hope it would be some form, they're talking about some sense of sovereignty and independence within a larger structure. The thing that we always talked about was that we hoped that Pristina would be more interested in what was happening in Brussels than what was happening in Belgrade, that there would be a larger concept of Europe and the Balkans would be a part of that. So we'll just have to see. But what Bishop Artemia is doing is not helpful. What Kostunica is doing in Belgrade is not helpful. The new constitution of Serbia is not helpful because in many ways it prejudges something that is part of a process now.
Thank you.
Yeah.
First, I wanted to thank you for coming to speak with all of us. I think we all greatly appreciate it. My name is Elizabeth Mackin. I'm a graduate student studying conflict resolution at Columbia. And the question I want to pose to you is, in your research, what do you think are the limitations of engaging faith-based activities and religious leaders? And the example I'll offer you is in Ayutthaya in India over the conflict about whether or not there should be a kovil or a mosque based on a very ancient religious site. Hindu activists in, I believe, 2002 tore down a mosque. And since then, there have been various riots that have broken out, even preceding that event. And it's not so much that either side disagrees on the history of the site, but rather, for both sides, it's a matter of faith. And I wonder if there's a time when, in fact, politics for the sake of politics or policy for the sake of policy is really the most prudent action.
Well, I think that, you know, the main thing is people have to stop killing each other over God. And I think the question is to what extent whether higher level religious leaders can help to resolve it or whether political leaders in concert with religious leaders can help to resolve it. And I think that each of these issues in many ways has to be a case-by-case thing. I mean, sometimes the religious leaders are the best people to work it out, and other times when the political situation gets into it, it may be a way to resolve. This particular issue is a very difficult one, and it is one I think ultimately the religious leaders have to decide. But the problem, and this, you know, I may get excommunicated from every church I've ever belonged to, is we sometimes act as if religious leaders all have a beneficent view and that they really can resolve issues always for good. But you have to understand that religious leaders are also very political. And so the problem is how, and this is the real problem in all the suggestions that I've made, is how do you find the right religious leaders, those who have the good of the people at heart and not a way that they score political points. But if you go back through history of any one of the religions, they have been very political at different times. So could I just conclude with something that I like to read, because I think it goes back to what I really, on the America question, and some of it you stated, but I worked hard on this, so if I could read it, I think it. Ours is a country of abundant resources, momentous accomplishments, and unique capabilities. We have a responsibility to lead, but as we fulfill that obligation, we should bear in mind the distinction pointed out by John Adams. Liberty, at least in the sense of free will, is God's gift, not ours. It is also morally neutral. It may be used for any purpose, whether good or ill. Democracy, by contrast, is a human creation. Its purpose is to see that liberty is directed into channels that respect the rights of all. As the world's most powerful democracy, America should help others who desire help to establish and strengthen free institutions, but in so doing, we should remember that promoting democracy is a policy, not a mission, and policies must be tested on the hard ground of diplomacy, practical politics, and respect for international norms. Our cause will not be helped if we're so sure of our rightness that we forget our propensity as humans to make mistakes. Though America may be exceptional, we cannot demand that exceptions be made for us. We're not above the law, nor do we have a divine calling to spread democracy any more than we have a national mission to spread Christianity. We have, in short, the right to ask, but never to insist or blithely assume that God bless America. Thank you.